picking up some ground fire down there, it looks like. I'm going to have to change my running heading. I'll still turn left here and keep clear of you.
During the Tet Offensive of 1968, the North Vietnamese Army had staged through the A Sha Valley an entire division and other VC forces for its massive attacks on Hue and Da Nang. Those attacks were a moral victory for the North, but militarily, they were a disaster. In the battle for Hue alone, the NVA lost over 5,000 men. By early 1969, it was becoming apparent to the MACV, Military Assistance Command Vietnam, and 24 Corps staffs that A Sha Valley was once again an area of high NVA activity. Logistically and strategically, the valley was an important terminus for the Ho Chi Minh Trail. The third of the 187th Battle for Dong Nai and the discovery of mammoth supply depots in the area served to accentuate that point. In May of 1969, the American command planned to clear out the A Sha Valley using 10 battalions of infantry, including the 9th Marine Regiment, the 3rd Arvin Regiment, the 3rd of the 5th Cavalry, and 3 air assault battalions, 1st of the 506th, 2nd of the 501st, and 3rd of the 187th. The overall plan of attack called for the Marines and the 3rd of the 5th Cavalry to combat assault into the valley and RIF, reconnaissance in force, toward the Laotian border, while the Arvin units cut the highway through the base of the valley. The 501st and the 506th mission were to destroy the enemy in their own operating areas and block escape routes into Laos. On May 10th, the 3rd Battalion, 187th Regiment of the 101st, known since World War II as the Rockhanses, began their attempt to clear out and capture Op Bai Mountain, where the 29th Regiment of the NVA was entrenched in bunkers and supplied from NVA elements operating in Laos, less than a mile away. The terrain in the area favored the defenders. The mountains they were to defend and their ridges were along the Trung Pham River on the Laotian border. The area was covered with a tropical double and triple canopied jungle. The land beneath the trees was a tangled mass of sawtoothed elephant grass, thick stands of bamboo, and other tough vines that inhibited foot movement, even without an enemy presence. The hills gave way to ridgelines, cut with deep ravines, saddles, draws, and smaller hills. It was an area long occupied by the NVA and fortified with bunkers, spider holes, deep tunnels, trenches, and underground shelters for aid stations, command posts, and storage depots. And this time, the NVA intended to stay their ground. Firebase Blaze was 20 kilos south of Op Bai Mountain. In the early morning hours, 1,800 men from 5 battalions, 1st of the 506th, 2nd of the 501st, and 3rd of the 187th from the 101st Airborne Division, and 4th of the 1st and 2nd of the 1st Arvin were assembled there to await liftoff. In the pre-dawn hours, the troops lounged about the area, cleaning weapons, napping, smoking, talking, and wiping off sweat from the early morning heat. Pilots and door gunners stood by some of the Hueys that would air assault the troops into the battle area. The men were poised to launch the largest air mobile assault in the Vietnam War. 10 artillery batteries were laid and ready to fire from fire bases Bradley, Airborne, Currahee, Berchtesgaden, and Cannon, having been moved into their firing positions only 16 hours before the invasion. H hour was 0730. In the hour before the helicopter launch, fighter bombers had bombed the LZs for 50 minutes. The artillery followed for the 15-minute mark. Then came aerial rocket artillery helicopters for a one-minute frosting on the Cape. The troops could hear their bombs blasting the enemy defenses and, they hoped, cutting down their losses later. At 0649, the TAC air prep stopped, and the troops prepared to saddle up. The lift helicopters, UH-1Ds, began to arrive at Fire Base Blaze in groups of 16, for a total of 64. At 0730, H hour, the 64 Hueys and the first 400 men and the lead companies of the 1st of the 506th and 3rd of the 187th, covered by Cobra gunships, were on their way to the northern Oshawa Valley. The Hueys flew to the south, across the Oshawa Valley, and then, using the walls of the valley as a screen, turned to the north along the Laotian border to their LZs. By 0800, D Company, then A and C, landed on LZ-2 without opposition. 10 minutes later, the troops were moving toward their assigned locations and setting up defensive positions. As planned, Captain Dean L. Johnson and his C Company secured the LZ. Captain Gerald R. Harkins and his A Company moved out toward the Laotian border. Captain Luther L. Sanders led his D Company to the south-southwest, passed through the Battalion CP on LZ-2, and headed up the ridge, protruding to the northwest of Dong Ap Bai. At 0945, Colonel Honeycutt and his command ship landed on LZ-2. Honeycutt relieved Captain Dean Johnson of LZ security, and Johnson and C Company moved out toward the border. Then Honeycutt and part of his staff began to move up the mountain ridge behind D Company, and at about 1100, linked up with Sanders about 1,000 meters from the top of the mountain. Helicopters hovering slowly overhead reported enemy trails, campsites, supply dumps, and bunkers. The signs of the enemy were becoming ominous. Honeycutt began to sense the enemy around him and radioed Colonel Conmee to release B Company to him. Conmee readily agreed, and B Company arrived at LZ-2 about 14:30. Captain Charles L. Littman, who had taken over from Captain Robinson on May 8th and would command the company for only 12 days, commanded B Company. At about 15:30, B Company reached Honeycutt's battalion CP. Honeycutt ordered Littman to move his company up the mountain. Colonel Curtin remembered seeing the mountain for the first time.
One of the things was the high ground. We needed to get a look on the high ground, and so I went out there one day. It was a mission of taking a look at this hill. I think it was about 314, which meant meters above sea level, and we got shot at, and I put some infantry on the ground, and one thing led to another, and the kids got into a pretty tight fight.
After reaching the uppermost portion of the ridge, the company moved several hundred meters to the northeast and then proceeded south along a second ridge. As the company moved, the enemy's presence could be felt. Lookout towers high in the burrows of the canopy were passed. Joint sections of bamboo, freshly cut for their water content, were strewn about. Spider holes and punji pits were encountered. B Company moved slowly, hoping to make the summit before dusk. The sound of artillery impacting on the hill, the ridges, and in the valleys and ravines was pleasing to the ears. The faint ping of mortar fire coming from the battalion CP at D Company's location was reassuring. Suddenly, a round whined overhead, then another. Contact! Small arms fire began to pour in. The second platoon, led by Lieutenant Marshal Edwards, dispersed and returned fire. The bushes, the trees, the jagged rocks all seemed steeped with the violence of armed combat. The smell of cordite hung low over the anxious troops. Artillery was just within 25 meters of the platoon, with shrapnel falling into friendly positions. The firing subsided, then flared again as the Rockhansens moved forward. When more heavy explosives were poured onto the enemy positions, the fire lessened and then stopped. Sweep teams found 4 enemy bodies and 4 AK-47s. Artillery pounded the area throughout the night. Honeycutt ordered Littman to dig in and establish NDP, night defensive positions. The Screaming Eagles would not make the summit that day, nor would they make it for many days to come. Just prior to dawn, the Rockhansens, in NDPs, launched a mad minute. Heavy machine gun and automatic rifle fire out of the perimeter into the enemy positions. Cobra gunships were on station overhead, At 0750, B Company, with Lieutenant Denholm's 4th Platoon in the lead, moved out. As the platoon made its way up the denuded ridge, the men found bloody trails, weapons, gear, and 8 enemy KIAs.
I told the young soldiers, I said, you know, this is going to be tough. A platoon of infantry is not very much, and we got our own gunships. But I promised them any time we got into a fight, we'd get out quickly. We'd get in, we'd get out, and let the big boys, let the infantry get in there and let them pile on. It was a pile-on theory. Well, we got caught late in the day, in the mid-afternoon, and got some kids on the ground and got out there overnight, and we couldn't pile on.
Throughout the late morning and early afternoon, the other three companies slugged on, finding fresh bunkers, communication wire, and other NVA gear. At about 1600, Denholm's men hit the enemy head-on. An enemy soldier sprang from a hole and shot Spec 4 Aaron Rosenstrike in the chest. Spec 4 John McCarroll was blown to bits by an NVA rocket. Rosenstrike died moments later. Denholm was blown down the trail, but even deaf and stunned, he called for a machine gun. Spec 4 Terry Larson rushed forward and was shot through the head. Spec 4 Donald Mills rushed forward with an M60 and was shot through the chest. Seconds later, he got up, charged, and emptied his weapon into the sniper. In a bind, the B Company men grenaded the area around them and pulled back, carrying their dead and wounded with them. Honeycutt called in artillery and airstrikes. At 1730, gunships flew over the area. During one strike, a gunship misfired and hit Honeycutt's CP with rockets. He was hit and two of his men killed. 35 men were wounded, including Battalion Sergeant Major Bernie Meehan. Honeycutt got on his radio and demanded that all aircraft check with his CP before launching strikes and halt all ARA, aerial rocket artillery, until friendly positions were marked more clearly. Later that day, from documents found on an NVA soldier and translated by his Kit Carson scout, Honeycutt and the brigade intelligence officer Captain Fredericks estimated that the 29th NVA Regiment was on the mountain with a strength of between 12 and 1,800 men, heavily reinforced with weapons. The 29th mission, according to the documents, was to infiltrate down to the plains and attack Wei. With the new intelligence, Honeycutt realized that his enemy was a major force and one ready and able to fight. He ordered Captain Johnson to move his C Company east toward the Op Bai Mountain. He directed Harkins to move A Company back up the ridge to the battalion CP to relieve D Company. He told Sanders to use D Company to clear a ravine to the northeast and then attack up the mountain from that position. On the 12th and 13th, the battle raged on with a new intensity. During the 12th, 8 airstrikes pummeled the enemy positions, the last one at 1734. The strikes included high drag bombs, napalm, and 500 and 1,000-pound bombs with delayed fuses. As the gunships left, artillery fire, 105s, 155s, and 8-inch, blasted the area with great accuracy. B Company started up the ridge when the fire lifted.
So that was a long day. It was a long night. I think I flew 17 hours that day, but we stayed over them. We got some gunships over them, and we could talk to them, and we dropped in some supplies.
The bombing and napalm had opened trails in the jungle, and the men saw enemy bunkers that they blasted with recoilless rifles. The fire caused the NVA soldiers to spring from their spider holes. They rolled grenades down on the Rickhansans, wounding 6 men. Littman moved his company back down the ridge, carrying the wounded with them. Helicopter gunships and fighter bombers returned to cover the area with Snake and Nape. In the D Company area, Sanders was having trouble. As the single lines of men moved slowly and cautiously through the ravines and dense jungle, they were hit from 3 directions by many snipers high in the trees. The D Company troopers raked the trees with gunfire, but progress was slow. They could hear the enemy all around them. Honeycutt wanted another LZ near B Company. One of the helicopters bringing in the engineers and their equipment was hit by enemy fire and crashed. But most of the engineers landed safely, rescued their gear, and with B Company help, by 1500, had completed the lower LZ. Honeycutt had another LZ carved out 100 meters north of his CP, known as the Upper LZ.
And the idea was to get a company of infantry with the assault helicopters and pile in, get my guys out and their guys in. But this hill was honeycombed. I mean, it had been long a bastion of the non-friendlies to live and to eat and to do whatever else they did in it. This was their turf, and we were going to invade it, and it had been seriously honeycombed. And they had set it up to defend it, to the bitter end.
By evening, C Company, after being ambushed in late afternoon when rocket-propelled grenades hit the trees above them and suffering 8 wounded, was in an NDP, 500 meters southeast of Lower LZ. B Company's NDP was located 350 meters northeast of the Lower LZ. D Company was 500 meters to the north of the Lower LZ. A Company and the battalion command post remained at the blocking position next to the Upper LZ. During the night, the NVA probed all the NDPs and at midnight hit the NDPs with accurate mortar fire. At 0656 on the 13th, the forward air controller, FAC, arrived on station and directed 10 airstrikes against the known enemy fortifications. The Phantom jets used delayed action ordnance to penetrate the canopy and explode in depth in the bunkers, trenches, and spider holes. The Rockhansens were well aware that the enemy troopers ducked into the tunnels and bunkers at the sound of the jets and came out as soon as they left the area. After the early morning airstrikes, B and C companies resumed their treacherous climb up the ridge toward the enemy's dug-in positions and suffered a withering attack from a nest of snipers and small arms, RPGs, and hand grenades. More and more wounded, 3rd of the 187th soldiers from B and C companies made their way back down the trail. Other Rockhansens carrying cans of ammo and grenades passed them on the way up. In the C Company CP area, 2 men were killed and 5 wounded by an NVA attack into their security perimeter. The artillery forward observer called for fire and broke up the attack. D Company was having an equally difficult time about 600 meters from the battalion command post, wading through a river, climbing up the side of a ravine, and then attacking toward the top of Op Bai. The NVA hit them with rocket-propelled grenades, badly wounding 3 men. Across the river, another RPG hit the 3rd platoon, wounding 5 men, and blowing Lieutenant Mattioli off the ridge and into the river. Delta Company, with platoons on both banks of the ravine, returned the fire with every available weapon and called for gunships. They also called for a medevac helicopter, which arrived on the scene at 15:10 hours. As the Rockhansens were hoisting the wounded into the hovering helicopter, an RPG slammed into it. It crashed down on PFC George Pickle, killing him instantly. One of its whirling blades killed Spec 4 William Springfield and wounded Miguel Marino. Captain Luther Sanders watched in agony. He now had 7 wounded and 7 dead. His company would have to carry all of them out by litter. Delta Company started back up the mountain through the river bottom.
By the morning of the third day, there was a pretty good command force and a presence. Colonel John Honeycutt had a battalion, and he was going to crank up a big company and a half, and they were going to go in, and my guys were going to come out. But I'd stay with him, and we'd work the perimeter, and this was a start. The hill was named by the number 3-something, 4-something. Well, this turned into a hell of a fight.
And the worst was yet to come. Then the rain came in torrents. Sanders halted his column and set up an NDP and called in artillery to surround his perimeter with close-in, constant shelling throughout the night. On May 14th, the Eagles threw in everything they had at the entrenched enemy.
We prepped the hill with not only artillery fire, but we used aircraft. Air Force aircraft, and we literally blew away as much of the cover as possible. We tried to uncover the hill. They were dug in. They were honeycombed, and they'd wait. They'd wait us out.
At 0646, the FAC reported into Honeycutt CP and directed 13 airstrikes, napalm and 1,000-pound bombs, on the mountain throughout the day. The artillery from the nearby firebases blasted the area constantly. C Company moved east from its NDP location up a small finger. B Company moved to the east from its NDP location up a small finger about 150 meters north of C Company. Both companies came into contact immediately, but pressed on, with C Company reaching the military crest of the hill at 0843. C Company found itself in a ferocious fight when the NVA pummeled them with small arms fire and RPGs. The troops kept moving forward, but the NVA came out of their holes, firing AK-47s. Goff's men were hit from all sides. Two were killed and 15 wounded. John Riley remembers running into the enemy, popping out of one of those well-concealed spider holes that honeycombed the mountainside.
At this time, I think I was carrying a grenade launcher, and which is an M79 grenade launcher, a poop pipe, they called it. And it wasn't a frontline weapon in the area we were in, anyway. And I was about the third or fourth guy back in the column, depending upon how the patrols were going out.
As Riley's company was trying to find an open area to flank the NVA position on the mountainside, the point man uncovered a spider hole along the trail.
The last thing I remember before I was shot was that I was, I had taken a fragmentation grenade off of my my ammo belt. I was going to throw that in the spider hole. But see, we were so close, I was reluctant because a grenade can kill you just as easily it kills the person you were trying to kill with it because of the exploding radius. And I'd taken it off, and someone passed it up, "Move out, damn it." Only it wasn't damn it. It was a little more explicit than that, you know, profanities and, you know, move out. You know.
Cautiously, Riley and the lead platoon moved forward as ordered.
Put the grenade back on. And I was moving on the hole with my rifle in the set position, okay? And I stepped on a branch of all the things, and it snapped, and I momentarily looked down. And when I looked, just in a matter of seconds, I looked back up, and I see the muzzle flash from the AK-47. You know, I was just I could almost touch the guy.
Every weapon in the lead platoon was unleashed upon the rifleman in the well-placed hole. But Riley was down injured and embarrassed.
I remember laying on the ground, and I was disgusted with myself because I'd made a mistake, and I knew I'd made a bad mistake. The first thing I remember feeling was I was disgusted with myself. Why are you screwed up? And I took a lot of pride on being good at what I did, okay? And, you know, no one likes to think they made a stupid little mistake like that gets them hurt that bad.
Trooper Riley had more than a mistake to worry about. He was bleeding to death on a mountainside in Vietnam.
And the blood, see, I had a chunk of skull blown away is what it basically was. And the blood was profusely all over me, you know. And I mean, I fell on top of my gun, and I kept trying to lift it up. And I remember I was looking at my arm, and I didn't have the strength to lift it up. You know, I kept trying to lift it up to shoot, and I could not lift it up. But this is after I got to see it. Of course, the blood was all over me. You know, I had a massive amount of blood all over me. Any type of head injury like this, you bleed profusely, you know, especially with a chunk of skull actually just shot away. And I remember trying to lift the gun up, you know, but I couldn't do it. And the guy that was hit twice to come up and put a bandage on me, and he went back for more bandages, and he told me he was going to go back. And I remember being so lonely. I just didn't want to be alone. I didn't want to be left alone.
The lead platoons of B and C companies began to fall back under heavy NVA fire. Spec 4 John Comerford crawled up with an M60 machine gun and sprayed the bunkers, but it was not enough. Honeycutt sent a platoon from A Company to cover the withdrawal. Unfortunately, as it moved up, it was hit by helicopter gunships firing rockets that killed Spec 4 Edward Brooks and badly wounded three other men. Lieutenant Donald Sullivan and his second platoon of C Company tried to help them fall back. C Company now had a total of 52 men killed and wounded. By 1700, the Rakansans were in NDPs, and Honeycutt asked for a situation report. He learned that he had lost 12 KIA and 80 badly wounded men. By 1920, though, he had medevaced all his dead and wounded out of the area. At 2000, a spooky arrived on station, and throughout the night, laced the area west of the Rakansan position toward the Laotian border. With the coming of the dawn, the situation remained the same. The NVA still held the mountain, and the sky troopers were looking for a way to break their hold. During the morning hours of May 15, 1969, the gunships and 10 artillery fire bases repeated their almost incessant bombing of the enemy positions as they had done the previous days, reducing the mountains and ridge lines to smoldering piles of blackened and smoking tree stumps, churned up earth denuded of vegetation. At 1200, A and B companies attacked the same two fingers they had assaulted the previous day. Sergeant First Class Louis Garza led 4th Platoon from B Company over the same ground, and two Claymore mines hit and wounded his two-point men. Garza called for air support. After the strike with 250-pound bombs, Garza and his platoon moved forward, firing their machine guns and M-16s, overran the bunkers, and killed 8 NVAs. But sniper and machine gun fire halted his advance. He marked the enemy position with smoke and called for helicopter gunships. Unfortunately, the first gunship salvoed an entire rack of rockets into B Company's CP. Higher up the trail, Garza and his men were hit by an NVA counterattack that PFC's Snyder and Marinuski drove off with machine gun fire. Lieutenant Frank McGreevy and his 1st Platoon of A Company were stopped in front of a line of bunkers. He tried to move forward, but a machine gun team led by Spec 4 Michael Leiden was hit by return fire that killed Leiden. McGreevy's platoon was now cut in half, and he ordered a withdrawal. Honeycutt called off the attack and told B and C companies to set up a joint NDP. He also called in his artillery liaison officer and gave him a message to get back to the division staff. "I want you to make sure that everybody gets this. I mean the artillery people and the gunship pilots and the liaison officers, everybody. I don't want any more ARA out here if they can't shoot the enemy instead of us. I'm tired of taking more casualties from friendlies than from the enemy. The next goddamn son of a bitch who comes out here and shoots us up, we're going to shoot his fucking ass down. And that's final. Now you go back and tell him that." During the night, NVA sappers out of Laos moved up the draw and tried to hit C Company and the battalion CP. A shadow gunship, a C-119 armed with 3 miniguns, took them under fire. On May 17, 1969, Honeycutt put the day on hold and had his men prepare for the assault the next day by stockpiling supplies, passing out new protective gas masks, and bring up concussion grenades for use against the dug-in NVA in bunkers. The first of the 506th, fighting up the mountain crest and taking casualties, had still not arrived in a support position. There was little contact during the hours of darkness. Early in the morning of May 18, 1969, the usual prep fires of air and artillery pounded the mountaintop. The first CS gas rounds, however, landed in the middle of A Company, and Division made the decision to call off the CS attack. At 10:25, A and D companies moved out. In D Company's area on the flank of A Company, Lieutenant Thomas Lipscomb and his 3rd Platoon were in the lead. At a bunker line, the enemy fire was heavy. 3 men went down, and Lipscomb yelled for his men to move up. Lipscomb charged a trench line with 2 other men while 3 of his men laid down covering fire. A grenade exploded at Lipscomb's feet, blowing him back down the hill and killing him instantly. Sanders realized that he had to get moving or, standing still, lose more men. He ordered Lieutenant Jerry Walden and his 1st Platoon to continue the attack. Shortly thereafter, Sanders was shot in the arm, and Lieutenant Walden took over the company. He called Honeycutt and called for more ammo. Helicopters arrived shortly, hovering a few feet over the ground while the crew threw out boxes of ammo. Walden told the colonel his Rockhansans were not going to back off. Walden moved his men up the skirmish line. They leapfrogged from log to log and crater to crater. NVA grenades flew through the air. Lieutenant Walden moved up and down the line, studying his men. They began taking flanking fire. 2 Rockhansans tried to rush forward. They were both shot down. Private First Class Willie Kirkland, 1st Platoon medic, moved up to give aid. He was hit 5 times in the chest. While PFC Roger Murray laid down covering fire, Sergeant Tom McGale and PFC Michael Rockland ran up and pulled Kirtland into a bomb crater. Kirtland died a few minutes later. At 11:37, Lieutenant Walden reported to Honeycutt that he was within 75 meters of the top. But minutes later, Walden and First Sergeant Thomas Stearns were hit by shrapnel. D Company was without officers, and all platoons were running low on ammunition. Honeycutt told them to hold fast, that he would send help. He contacted Captain Johnson and ordered him to move C Company up the hill to reinforce what was left of A and D Companies, to take all the ammo they could carry and take over D Company as well as his own men. Honeycutt realized the gravity of his situation. He called Colonel Conmee, briefed him on his very difficult situation, and asked for another company, a fully intact air assault company. Conmee told him that it would be airborne in minutes, but that became open to discussion later. Honeycutt had been expecting another company to help him take Op Bai. Unknown to him, the 101st Division commander, Major General Zayas, deeply concerned about the Rokkansan casualty, had stopped the reinforcing company from joining the battle. At 1700, General Zayas arrived at Honeycutt CP. The Rokkansans were a battered battalion. During the day, A and C Company had lost 9 men each. B had lost 4. The Delta, 39. Zayas wanted to know if Honeycutt could fight on. Honeycutt said that he would need just one company more. Zayas was hesitant. Honeycutt was adamant. At 1830, A Company, 2nd of the 506th, began to land by helicopter on the upper LZ. That night, the company remained with B, 3rd of the 187th, in a blocking position while A, C, and D Companies set up NDPs within a few hundred meters of the lower LZ, 100 meters north of the battalion command post. At 0630, May 19th, the jets arrived and pounded the enemy positions with 7 airstrikes using bombs, napalm, and rockets. For some reason, the NVA popped purple smoke grenades. No friendly forces used grape, so the jets had some accurately marked targets to hit. During the morning, D Company and A, 2nd of the 506th, moved to the lower LZ. Honeycutt worked on his final plan of attack on the mountain, slated for the morning of the 20th. Other units moved into locations for the final assault. 2nd of the 3rd Arvin moved by helicopter from Wei to an LZ 1,000 meters south of Op Bai, and then climbed northwest to an assault position 500 meters from the top of Hill 900. 3 companies of the 2nd of the 501st were airlifted from Firebase airborne to an LZ 800 meters northeast of Op Bai, and they walked to within 400 meters of the base of Hill 937. The 1st of the 506th attacked south of the mountain. Over a captured radio, Honeycutt got a message from the NVA. Blackjack, we're going to kill all of your men tomorrow. When you come up to the mountain in the morning, Blackjack, we'll be waiting for you. All of your men are going to die. Can you hear me, Blackjack? All will die. We'll see who dies tomorrow, asshole, Honeycutt barked. For 2 hours, beginning around dawn, May 20th, 1969, the Air Force jet and Sky Raider pilots bombed all 4 sides of Op Bai with every type of armament they could scarf up at their bases. The air crews came a long way to strike the enemy and support the grunts assaulting the mountain.
And these aircraft came from Binwa, which was way south, 400 miles, obviously Da Nang. Every place up and down the coast, these guys were coming in, and they were flights of 3. And all kinds of ordnance. And they were stacked in holding patterns 1,000 feet apart, and the FAC would just bring them in. And they would drop their ordnance.
Like the sequence of the previous 10 days, when the pairs of planes left the area, the artillery blasted the NVA positions with tons of 105mm, 155mm, and 8-inch artillery rounds. At 10:00, the 4 infantry battalions assaulted the burning, scorched mountaintop. When the troops reached the base of the mountain, they formed long skirmish lines and began to move cautiously up the slope. The hill was eerily silent. And in 10 minutes, the 3 companies had reached the first bunker line, now seemingly deserted. As a precaution, the troopers destroyed the bunkers with grenades and satchel charges. 20 minutes later, their lines were just 100 meters from the military crest of Op Bai. and closing in on the second bunker line. The mountain was quiet for 10 minutes. Then, at about 10:40, when the skirmish lines were just 75 meters from the top, the bunkers came alive with a rain of RPGs at point-blank range. 10 to 15 NVA hit C Company, wounded 7 Rakhansans. 10 meters later, the men topped the mountain. They did not realize it at the time, but they were the first Americans to set foot on Dong Up Bai. The time was 11:45, exactly 9 days and 5 hours after Bravo Company first made contact on the mountain.
The kids, it was just unbelievable. It's hard for me, as I was flying out every day, it was hard for me to think what motivated these young men on day two and day three and day four, because they'd see these kids go up and down, and we were putting fresh people in, and we were dropping ordnance that, I mean, thank God we had a logistical tail. It was, pretty wide and long and deep. But there were sorties of Air Force aircraft in holding patterns waiting to get in on Hamburger Hill to drop the ordnance and get out.
The NVA were still dug in all over the top of the mountain, and before the squad could move any further, they were pinned down by fire coming from half a dozen enemy positions. Then C Company reached the top of the mountain. The surviving NVA deserted their bunkers and ran down the west face of the mountain in the draw between hills 900 and 910 toward Laos. Overhead, Honeycutt directed 81mm mortar fire into the draw, while B, first of the 506th, sent a force below the draw and waited for the NVA to emerge. When they did, they ran into a wall of fire. But the NVA was aggressive. On the western face of the mountain, C-187th set up a perimeter. Honeycutt ordered Captain Harkins to move his A Company up the mountain to reinforce C Company. Harkins rallied his troops and moved up. About 30 meters from the top, Harkins took a shot through his neck that lodged in his back. He staggered a few feet and fell into a shell hole. A medic bandaged Harkins. The NVA in the last bunker line refused to give up, pinning down A Company's troops. At the same time, an NVA squad hit C Company's right flank. Pinned down on the far right side of Alpha's skirmish line, Spec 4 Johnny Jackson, a machine gunner in the 3rd platoon, huddled behind a log and thought, "Here we go again." Another attack failed. As he cowered there, though, he suddenly remembered what he had boastfully told a friend earlier in the morning. "I'll tell you what," he had said. "If we go up that son of a bitch this time, I'm staying up. I ain't going to be run down again and let them assholes shoot me in the back. I'm through with this retreating bullshit." He kept thinking of his words now, and then on impulse, stood up and shouted out loud so everyone in the 3rd platoon could hear him, "Fuck this bullshit!" With a fluid motion, Jackson brought his M60 up to his chest and raked the enemy position above, then charged up the side of the mountain, wildly spraying bullets from side to side. Below him, his friend, Spec 4 Michael Vallone, frightened but inspired by Jackson's charge, yelled, "Follow me!" Fired short bursts from his M16 and led his squad, then the platoon, and the rest of A Company up the mountain. A Company rolled over the last bunker line and made it to the top. The wounded Captain Harkins set up a perimeter defense tied to C Company, turned the company over to Lieutenant Gordy Acheson, and then began his laborious trek down the mountain. To the southwest, B Company, first of the 506th, was in a tough battle. Two platoons of NVA, firing satchel charges, roared down the hill through the shattered platoon, then raced back up through it again. Fighting was close and brutal. 15 minutes later, the 3rd platoon had 10 dead and was surrounded by a pile of NVA KIAs. Lieutenant Colonel John Bowers, CEO of the 1st of the 506th, ordered Captain William Stymest, C Company CO, to send a force up the hill to relieve the battered 3rd platoon. In a two-hour fight, C Company made it to the top, where 65 dead NVA littered the area. From his helicopter, Honeycutt could see the NVA running in all directions off the mountain. B Company, 1st of the 506th, was still in a blocking position to cover the southwestern draw. Honeycutt brought in two fighter bombers to strafe up and down the draw, and then brought in artillery fire. The Rakansans on the top and slopes of Dong Ap Bai found a landscape that resembled what they imagined hell must be like. Throughout the area, they found NVA pith helmets, AK-47s, stick grenades, bloody bandages, and RPGs. Honeycutt began the mop-up operation at about 1500. One POW, 18-year-old Pham Van Hai, told his interrogators that 80% of his 100-man company and the 29th NVA Regiment's 7th and 8th Battalions had been nearly wiped out. Later, Spec 4 Johnny Jackson and his squad, searching the top of the mountain, found an underground room containing the stripped and stacked bodies of more than 40 NVA soldiers. Other Rakhansans, searching the mountaintop, discovered in its deep tunnels many storage areas containing 152 individual and 25 crew-served weapons, 75,000 rounds of ammo, thousands of mortar and RPG rounds, and over 10 tons of rice. The 3rd Battalion of the 187th suffered 39 killed in action and 290 wounded. The total casualties of the Americans in taking Dong Ap Bai was 70 dead and 372 wounded. The losses inflicted on the NVA in Dong Ap Bai are debatable. The G2 section of the 101st estimated the NVA dead at 633, based upon actual body count. The third of the 187th's battle for Dong Ap Bai was over. For the next 17 days, the other three battalions would continue to mop up the mountain. But on 21st May, the Rakhansans were evacuated from the area to Camp Evans for a stand down at Eagle Beach. While the other battalions were policing the Dong Ap Bai battlefield, one imaginative soldier found a piece of cardboard sea ration box, wrote on it, Hamburger Hill, and nailed it to a charred tree trunk. Shortly thereafter, another, perhaps more practical and blunt soldier, had added beneath the sign, Was it worth it? His question would be debated in Congress, in the administration, in the media, and in many a gathering of military officers and men for months to come.
I remember having a reporter from someplace in the world, he stuck a microphone in front of me at a fire base. How he got out there, I have no idea, but he was no Ernie Pyle. And he stuck a microphone in my face and wanted to talk about Hamburger Hill. And I was pretty tired, and I probably wasn't very succinct, and I characterized it as ground round mound.
Shortly after the battle, a spokesman for General Creighton Abrams, General Westmoreland's successor as Com-U.S. MacV, said, We're not fighting for terrain as such. We're going after the enemy. But the debate about the value of Hamburger Hill was far from over. This was not the worst loss of life for Americans in Vietnam, but a May 19th newspaper story by Jay Charbot horrified the American public with vivid descriptions of the fighting and the casualties.
The action lasted about 11 days and was a tremendous big effort, American effort, to get out there and to take this hill. And after this period of time, we withdrew.
When the American command ordered the 101st Airborne to abandon Hamburger Hill, the American public was outraged. On June 19th, just a month after the battle at Ap Bai Mountain, President Nixon cleared up any uncertainty that there may have been about the U.S. policy in Vietnam. He gave explicit orders to the new U.S. commander, General Creighton Abrams, that he was to conduct the war with a minimum of American casualties. That same month, Nixon ordered that 25,000 U.S. troops be brought home by July 8th, and that 35,000 more come home by December. The war was winding down, but the dying was far from over.
There's a high-flying bird way up in the sky, and I wonder, does he look down as he flies on by? Riding on the air so easy in the sky. But Lord, look at me, yeah. I'm rooted like a tree, yeah. sky blue.